When we did Do for Love, Pac had passed away.
Yeah.
And Afeni called me and said, I only want people, he has a lot of material. We think about putting out some stuff he didn't finish, but I only want people that he really worked with to do it. And I remember she came up, and actually, the first song we did was not Do for Love. It was I Wonder if Heaven Got a Ghetto. And I don't know if you imagine, we were sitting with Afeni and we had these big speakers, and we just put the a cappella on because there's no music underneath. But actually, he starts playing these chords and he does some changes that are unusual for an R&B writer. And they write this song. We go to Clive. And now he's at the Belvis Hotel, always a Bungalow 8. I'm sure you heard that from other people. That was Mecca. And when we came there, Prince walked out, casually. Oh, hello, Prince. Again, maybe we're just not meant to be here. Like, this is too high level. Like, we go in and we press play, and he stops after the first song. We had three songs again, and he goes, 1 second. And he goes, Roy Lott, I need you to go in the room with Soulshock and Collins' manager. We're buying this record right now on the spot. And I need, they're not leaving until they sign the contract. I see a golf cart coming, and I kid you not, Bobby and Whitney coming up in a golf cart. Bobby's holding a bottle of Hennessy. The golf cart is swirling like this. And Robin goes, are you ready?
Hi guys, I want to welcome you to another edition of Halftime Chat. And today I've got another special guest. I'm talking to the producer. He's also a DJ, and he goes by the name of Soul Shock. And he's part of the big R&B production crew of Soul Shock and Carlin out of Denmark. So it's going to be great talking to him, seeing his career, his background, his inspiration, and talking about going through some of the tracks that he produced from Whitney Houston's Heartbreak Hotel, Monica's Before You Walked Out of My Life, Do for Love by Tupac, and so many others. Okay, take care. Back, yes, fine.
Okay, great. Then we'll just do without earbuds. How are you?
I am doing very well. I'm doing very well. It is about 10 o'clock here in the UK.
Yeah, I was just about saying you guys were on it late, huh?
Yes, well, yeah. I mean, I've I'm a full-time mental health therapist working with children. So this is
Oh,
my
beautiful.
yes, yeah. So I do my clinics in the morning. So when everyone goes to bed, my kids, my wife, then I can do my hobby at night.
Then you can do your thing.
Do my thing, yes.
Then you can
Just.
do your show.
Yeah, I can do that. So yeah, I started this during lockdown, and it's it's been fun just hearing the stories and putting a face. I mean, as I said, I most of us even know how you look like. We know your music, but we don't
I
even
know.
we didn't. Yes, yeah.
Let me tell you one thing. It's so funny when there was this big website, one of those soul R&B websites, and they put out a picture of us. And they're like, this is all the hits that we're doing. And people were like, no way. Don't tell me these two white boys from Denmark did though all those records. No way.
Yeah, I mean, being British, well, I'm British. I went to university in America, but there's a lot of soul. We're from George and Michael. We know the Beatles, they enjoyed sort of rock and roll.
Oh,
So
yeah.
it's understandable here in the UK. I mean, most of our DJs play soul and R&B and stuff and hip hop.
Yeah.
So, but I know in America, it's very different. So, yes.
I mean, I don't know if we're recording, but
Yeah, we
I
can do
can
it. Yeah.
tell you if you want
Yeah,
about
go ahead.
this. Since we're touching that subject, we came over here, well, I gotta go further back because, my original start to the music industry and everything is because of these two guys here at my decks. I
Okay.
was a DJ for many years, and in 1989, I became third in the world in the world championship in mixing and scratching, which was DMC. It was held at Royal Albert Hall.
Okay, here in the
It was
UK.
England who had this
Yeah.
world. Yeah, they had their world championship. And one of the judges was DJ Red Alert.
Oh, okay.
And that's really the beginning of my career because, I lived with my parents. I was so young. So I just went back to my little farmer town in Denmark, and it truly was. And then I got a phone call from Flavor Unit, and that was DJ Red Alert's new management company he had with a guy called Dave Funkenklein. And he said, we really like that show you did. We're doing a tour with Queen Latifah, Jungle Bros, Chill Ruff G, and True Mathematics. And we want you to DJ on that tour, but not just do your show. We want you to also be Latifah's DJ and Chill Ruff G's DJ and True Mathematics DJ. And I mean, it was just, what? Say that again? It was such an incredible honor. And I flew to New York. And for me, I was just into the music. My first experience with music was Grandmaster Flash, The Wheels of Steel.
Wow.
And ever since I heard that record, it was just that's it. But I didn't know the culture of hip hop. I didn't know really what it expressed. I just liked the music and I could hear what they were talking about. But I was just, the beats and everything was really what I was focused on. I came to New York and I stayed with Audio 2 and MC Light.
Wow.
And yeah, they were kind of helping me out a little bit because they were friends with Red Alert and stuff like that. But I mean, it was like, whoa. All of a sudden, I was in it, and I was in Brooklyn, Flatbush Avenue in the late 80s. And my mom was like, how is it? And I'm like, quite different. And doing that whole venture, that was my whole point, because we're touching this subject of, being a little white boy in hip hop music. It didn't exist. There were no M&Ms at all. There were few third base later on. Camp had a white kid, but it was really unusual. And I'm so thankful to this day that Latifah and Red Alert gave me this experience, because I would go on this tour, and I would tour in a lot in Europe too. But a lot of times when I went on stage, I got booed.
Oh, wow. In
Well,
Europe or in the US?
because they were here to see like straight out the jungle. Latifah was wearing African costumes, and Jungle Bros were like in full jungle gear and stuff like that. So I had to scritch and scratch and mix real fast. And I was like, oh, okay, he's cool, whatever. And it kind of got to me actually a little bit on the tour bus. I remember after many months of touring, I was just like, and also experiencing, New York. I got shot at in New York at a,
What?
yeah, at a club where, Red Alert had me spin in different clubs around in New York. But hip hop clubs in like 1989 were like, it was gritty. And there was someone who wasn't feeling the DJ, and I just, it was just a really rough experience coming from Denmark. And I remember saying to Latifah, you know what, after we've been touring for a while, I said, I don't know, maybe I should not be doing this.
Yeah, did the bullet actually hit you, or
No,
did
I didn't get hit. No, I didn't get hit. The promoter just told me that there's something going on, and just people in the crowd getting rowdy, and
Yeah.
also, what's this white boy doing up there, kind of thing, what kind of thing.
Wow.
It was just one of those, it was a tough little feeling back. And it's
Yeah.
not like England, where we used to different cultures in hip hop.
Yeah.
Most hip hop in England were mixed and stuff like that. It was never really an issue, because we as a country, England, Denmark, especially Denmark,
Yeah.
it's just more natural. But in New York, no. Not in the late 80s.
Yeah, yeah,
It was
yeah.
unusual. But anyways, I just remember he was like, oh yeah, you gotta duck down under the turntables, to stay safe. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, have my needles up, and I just hear over me. And I wish I could tell you some Superman story, but I crawled on all fours out and called my mom from the phone box as we had in New York back then, and said, I'm coming home. So I had experienced some stuff, and I just remember saying to Latifah, I was like, I love this music so much. I am so into this music, and I live and breathe it. But I'm just starting to sense maybe not. And she took my hands, she slapped my hands, and she goes, don't you ever let the color of your skin determine any decisions in life for you. And it was so reversed, because, hey, wait, I'm the white, okay, but she used some of the experiences she felt in being
A
in
bit
corporate white
female-ish.
world or something,
Yeah,
whatever.
yeah.
And it was just incredible. And that was really the moment when I'm like, okay, thank you, because I respect her so much. So I owe so much to Red Alert and Latifah of my and Jungle Brothers for the beginning of my career.
Yeah, well, I mean, it'd be great to go back to the fact that you're from, well, I always ask my guests where they were born and raised. You've said Denmark. Now, most of us know Denmark as the home of Lego and Danish pastry. So, you know, outside of, and Carlsberg, and, you know, I'm a little
Let me bring out my Lego gear for you.
Yeah. I'm surprised you don't have a big Lego mix at the back.
Hey, Pidwa, can you get me some Legos, please?
And as a Liverpool supporter, the home of Carlsberg beer. But what was it like growing up in Denmark?
I am, you know, Liverpool. And my best friend supports Liverpool. You know,
Jan
I'm
Mowgli,
myself Madrid,
yeah.
And my again, Mowgli was amazing. And you had some other things. Yeah,
we had Daniel Agger.
Maybe he was the biggest one, but
Daniel Agger.
I was just about to say, great defensive player.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Oh my God, my team is Madrid. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're good. Yeah.
But what was it like growing up in Denmark?
You know, very, you know, I'm from the northern part of Denmark, which is kind of like, it's
in
called Jutland.
Greenland, or is it?
Yeah, Jutland is called, yeah. So you got like where the capital is, you know, Copenhagen. We're not, we're the farmers.
Okay.
We're Jutland, a lot of cows,
wow.
A lot of farms. And I grew up with very traditional home. My dad was working at professor at the university and stuff like that. Very academic family. So when I said, "Yeah, I'm going to New York to make beats," just not at all registering, no idea what I was talking about. But they got used to the sound of this because I was practicing 8 hours a day in my room on my turntable. So, you know, but growing up, really traditional upbringing in Denmark, and you know, I remember around those years, 11, 12, 13, 14, you start to want to fit in,
yeah.
Right? So teenage, you find your little clique. And it was really hard in Denmark because first I was like, you know, I was a little bit of a tough guy. You are in the farmers, you're always like, you know, farmer boys always, you know, farmer boys.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of like with the rock, you know, heavy metal, bike kind of thing. And I'm like listening to the music, you know, and I'm like, this is terrible.
Wow.
So I left that. And then I went in the other posse that was kind of like, they were listening to Wham.
Okay.
Like Pink Shirts on and stuff. And I'm like, this is terrible. And I had such a hard time fitting in that I kind of hanging out with people who listened to The Cure and Sex Pistols and stuff like that. And I didn't, you know, I was okay, but I was coming home at night sometimes going, what's wrong with me? How come I can't, like, why am I fitting in? And that's the moment when I heard on Danish national radio, Grandmaster Flash, The Wheels of Steel. And I can't explain to you why, but it was just a moment for me. I was like, that's it. And I called all my friends, and there's one friend in particular who said, oh, that's that new style from New York. It's called hip hop. And I went all in. And you got to figure out what to do. You want to make graffiti? You're going to rap? You're going to break dance? And very fast, I found out I was not good at any of those. But music spoke to me. And I saw all the rappers had DJs behind them. And I started studying, you know, all the DJs, like, you know, Howie T and Cash Money and Jazzy Jeff and Mixmaster Ice from UTFO. And
wow.
I got really into studying all their styles, scratching and mixing. And that became my life.
No. Okay. So I'm, as I said, maybe those in America might not really comprehend the fact that Denmark, you know, apart from Scandinavia, has your ABBA and Ace of Base. You really, it just seems a mile away from hip hop. The fact that your radio station is playing that, it just seems like, well, how did they even get a hold of that? And then I'm sure your parents are like, well, what are they saying?
What are you doing?
You know, no, but your English, oh, well, you know, hip hop and everything. Yeah.
Yes. But, you know, we had a little bit of a breakdance commercial moment when hip hop came out. We had all the big movies breaking and stuff like
breaking,
that.
Breaking, you know, yeah. Toba Nova Zone. Yeah.
Yeah. And there was like, you know, breakdance became like, you know, everybody's running around with white gloves and doing the robot and all that stuff. So it wasn't super unusual to get into the culture because at that time it had a momentum. I think you probably in England too, we started seeing people breaking the streets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which we had in Denmark too, believe it or not, you know.
Oh.
But when that faded away, because that was just this break dance trend, you know, then the real hip hop b-boys as we stayed on, and that was really challenging because now we were like, what are you doing with this? That's over. You know,
Yeah.
I was told over and over, hip hop is over. It's going to be 3 years, 2 years. It's never going to be anything. Look at today.
Yeah.
Hip hop has absolutely outrun any other genre, and
Yeah.
its impact in commercial businesses, like from cars to homes to you know everything, fashion. You know, hip hop is a major influence of everything
Yeah.
we see in our culture today. So that's a big win for us.
Yeah, no, it's true. But why the turntables? Because when I interviewed Grandmaster D from Houdini, I said to him, he says, well, you know
Major respect for that, by the way.
what?
You know, that's, you know, when you say stuff like that, you go back to my youth here. Yes.
Yeah,
We
because you know
love
he was
Houdini.
saying,
Yes.
but back in those days, the DJ was the person, and the MC was you get an MC because the DJ did the parties, and so the MC they were more important than the MC. So it was interesting the fact that why you decided to do to be the DJ. Were you thinking, I'm going to get some MCs locally to rap over what I'm doing, or what was your thoughts?
Not at all. I was only into how did Grandmaster Flash do the Wheels of Steel?
Wow.
And I studied and I found out that he originally did that on three turntables.
Oh.
So that's why it was so hard to do it too. Because he's changing records really fast.
Wow.
And when you only have two turntables, you will have to have the vinyl stack on top of each other. So you just put it on and there's a vinyl to make it as fast as he did it.
Yeah.
So I just became obsessed with that song. That was all turntable DJing. So it was pretty clear from the beginning that's what I was going to do because it was the sounds that got me into the culture. And also, you know, when I did my first graffiti piece, you know, I show my friends, they're like, I don't think it's going to be a graffiti.
You know, it is interesting that you actually really are a student from hip hop from the beginning, because a lot of people might have heard some of the influences of your later production and thought that, oh, he's taking stuff from some of our hip hop producers and mixing him, whether it's Dilla and people like that, without
Well,
realizing
I want to
your
do.
history. Yeah.
I'm so happy we talk about this because that's actually one of the saddest things slash best things. Do For Love, we adored Jay Dilla. Jay Dilla for us hip hop producers is God. And Q-Tip too, by the way, just so you know, he is, those two guys are the first one who starts taking different pieces, but not from the same record. They would have like a bridge or something going in before the hook from another record. They would have horns from a third record on top of other sample. And, you know, I always hated when all these rock producers were like, oh man, you guys are just stealing stuff. Have you tried to put together a hip hop record? Because that's a lot harder to play a Van Halen solo. You can just copy, you know. It's so complicated to make hip hop. So I never took that. So when we Do For Love is a special moment in my life because we have worked with Pac. And, you know, I'm so happy that I got to work with him. We did a song called Old School. That was one of my first times I worked with him. And that was about East Coast hip hop. It was incredible because I knew everything about East Coast. And you forget, Pac is from New York.
You forget,
He is, I know he's the West Coast, but no, he is East Coast. So we had so much fun doing that record together because it was all about paying respect to all the original legends. And when the next record I did with him, when he called me, and I remember I was on Sunset Boulevard, and he said, you know, man, that record you did is going to be the title for my next album. I don't know if you can imagine being a little white boy from Denmark, but Me Against the World is our song we did with Tupac. That was the title of his album. It was so overwhelming. We were so thankful of it. When we did Do For Love, Pac had passed away.
Yeah.
And Afeni called me and said, you know, I only want people, he has a lot of material. We think about putting out some stuff. He didn't finish, but I only want people that he really worked with to do it. And I remember she came up, and actually the first song we did was not Do For Love. It was I Wonder If Heaven Got a Ghetto. And I don't know if you imagine, we were sitting with a Feeny, and we had these big speakers, and we just put the a cappella on because there's no music underneath. And he's talking about, I wonder if heaven got a ghetto, and he just passed away. And Feeny's just crying next to me.
Wow.
It was almost like speaking down from the speakers. And his original idea was this kind of up-tempo Bruce horn, I think he was called, piano. And I thought it was okay. And I said to Afina, can I try to do something else? And she goes, sure. And I did this, I don't know if you know the record, but I did this version of I Wonder If Heaven Got a Ghetto. That's the one they played at least over here in America. And I actually let him go. I take the beat half-tempo. So Pac kind of bounces, which was the current style, JC style, doing all that stuff. And it was so magical. And I found this cameo sampling, whatever. So I was so excited about it. And my wife, who passed away, Maxie, who was part of Brownstone, which is a big R&B group.
Oh, yes. Oh, that was lovely.
Yeah, that's the mother to my son. And she's singing on that record. we just started. Yeah. And then she came back, and the record company was so excited about this record we've done. I wonder if him are going to get him. She come in, and I have this other one called Do For Love. And obviously she played me the original song, Bruce. I always forget his name.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you want to do for love?
Yeah, yeah.
This is where it comes in.
Mm.
It's a long journey to get back here. But because Pac and I had really bonded over East Coast hip hop, and I was going to make an East Coast record for him because people didn't associate with that, but I knew Pac and very well, and he was very East Coast. I mean, the music he listened to was, he grew up listening to like Big Daddy Kane and Marley Marls and Bismarckies and all the stuff I grew up with. So there was a remix of Far Side that Jay Dilla did. And I took a little horn thing that goes do 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 do. I loved it. I said, I'm gonna take that little part, and I love the snare and the sample, which we are always, by the way, this was normal, like Premiere and all. We were all taking, you know, someone had a dope snare, we'll make it our own, but you know. And that's all there is from that record from Jay Dilla, is the little horn and the snare. And I used that in this, and ever since it's like, that's Jay Dilla who did this record, or whatever. And you know, in some way, the way when I hear that, I actually get honored. Because I never thought I was as good as Jay Dilla. Mm-hmm. So the fact they could think that that beat was Jay Dilla, you know, instead of taking it as like, no, it's me. You know, I'm kind of like, man, that's amazing. I'll take that because, you know, and I know that snare and that little horn was characteristic for him. So I don't want to take any away from those two sounds. But that's all that is from Jay Dilla on that record.
Yeah, I mean.
And it's become his own little momentum. You know, most important thing when I say the story is Jay Dilla is God. And the only reason why I took that was almost in some way paying respect to this East Coast record. It was kind of normal to do that. Like if I had to do something earlier, you know, Marley Marl was the big one. It wouldn't be unusual for me to maybe use the impeach the president's kick a snare that he used so much. You know, it's not unusual to do that in hip hop.
Yeah.
But, so that's the little story about the Jay Dilla thing and us doing Do For Love.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a good friends with Eric Williams, and so and he who sang the hook on it. So I love the record for that.
Thank you.
I didn't know anything about Jay Dilla, so I'm not a real hip hop person. It was only when I put out the fact that I'm going to interview you, and then a few people said, "Oh," and commented about this, and I'm thinking, "Oh, so I didn't know anything about it." So I thought it's only fair to ask just to bring it
absolutely
up. Yeah, because as I said, I didn't realize that there was a thing that you even heard about it, that people thought that you, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, that's the worst part of the story. I don't want to come off as we took someone or took someone's work and put our names on it. I mean, we've done.
Yeah, you've done. Yeah, you've done tons
60
of
records,
stuff.
You know. So, you know, But you know, in that incident, yeah, you know, looking back, maybe I should not have taken that little horn. Maybe I should have not sampled that snare because that created confusion, you know, and that's the last thing I wanted to do. I wanted Pac to have a little bit of a Tribe Called Quest, which was like my biggest inspiration of all. That's also why you hear when Colin, my partner, comes in, you know, he goes, "What are you hearing? What are we doing?" I go, "Tribe Called Quest." And he just goes, "Do, do, 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 do." I mean, that was because it was Tribe Called Quest. So it's natural for me because Dilla and Q-Tip were, you know, they were the one creating the sound. But you know, that's the confusion for this record. And you know, I hope everybody who hears this knows that we are only honored to be in that category. Jay Dilla for us is maybe the biggest hip hop producer ever.
But I guess it's strange because, and I wonder if this has anything to do with being from Denmark and being white, that this is the issue because, you know, my favorite producer is Teddy Riley,
Oh my God, can we just have a moment?
and
I cannot tell you how many hours in the studio I've spent trying to get that goddamn Teddy Riley snare. He is, I mean, we're touching someone. We just talked Jay Dilla. You know, this is you're going straight to my, if you ask who's your all-time Teddy Riley, by far is my biggest inspiration. So sorry, I just needed a moment.
Did you know him when did you know about him when you were in Denmark about the whole New Jack and Keith Sweat and the Heavy D and the Hip and the
Absolutely.
and
Absolutely.
Kumo D and
I knew him the first time I started hearing that sound. The first time I hear the sound of hip hop collaborating with R&B was Al B. Sure. You
Okay.
know, that's Kanye West, but Teddy's actually involved in that record too. He just didn't
I've
put it.
interviewed Carl West. Carl West, one of my good friends. I love Carl, and he talked about, you know, Teddy in the studio and just watching him and stuff. So, yeah. So your first time
And I
you
don't know
heard
if you
of the,
know, Teddy Riley also did Doggy Fresh the show. I didn't even know that.
He was the whole the whole Inspector Gadget stuff
Yeah,
and the
yeah,
whole
yeah.
keeping the flow going.
So trust me, you know, as soon as that, especially when Al B. Sure came out, I was on. I was on. And when Guy came out, it was over. You know, but all his remixes, everything I study, we can talk about Teddy from now. I need to get a bottle of wine or something was in
Yeah,
chat up from the
you
fire
can go ahead and
because
do that.
I'm obsessed with Teddy Riley. I mean, he was the sound he created, it was so spectacular. And he was up in Harlem in his little room up in Harlem, where his studio was. And what he did up there is insane. And he did much more than he even got credit for because you know, the story
Yeah,
with
the
his
story of
manager
Gene and
came
everything.
and took all credit and all that stuff. Yeah.
I mean,
But
being in hip hop then, did you know about, say, Kumo D when he did go, I get the job done, even for Big Daddy Kane,
Go see
and
the doctor
go
was
see
the
the
first one.
doctor? Yeah, I
Yeah.
work. He did the Heavy D and the
I know
Voice.
everything. I had everything, all that, everything. And that's why I'm still in Denmark. You know, that was what's so amazing was if you were into hip hop in Denmark, especially when it wasn't popular to be breakdancing anymore, you were into it because, you know, there would be no other reason to be into this. Because it wasn't popular in that sense, so you know we were the ones who were into it. We knew everything, everything. And Teddy, in particular, I studied so much as a producer. You know, I mean, just incredible. Let me just turn my phone off over here. You know, incredible. The amount of inspiration and Colin, my keyboard guy. You know, I'm the beat guy in our team. I cannot tell you. I mean, back then I made cassettes. After cassette, go, you got to learn these chords. I don't know what he's doing every time. He got these in it that just sound different, his chords. And he goes, wow, they really expanded these chords. And I go, I don't know anything about that, but can we get that on our records? You know, so we studied Teddy like beyond. He's probably the ones we maybe Jay Dilla and Q-Tip or Tribe Called Quest and then Teddy Riley. Those are the two biggest for me and Colin in everything we did.
I mean, one of my favorite
Watching like
albums.
really two big ones here.
One of my favorite albums is the Make It Last Forever Keith Sweat album, and the first song on it was Something Just Ain't Right, and it starts off with Teddy with the keyboards. It just starts with an intro of the keyboards before it goes into
And the way he plays, that's why my favorite parts on his records were Teddy's Jam. Teddy's Jam on the first Guy album and Teddy's Jam on the second is even better. We listen to that over and over and over and over again. And then I just could not understand how he got those snares to pop like that. And it's not until recently you kind of found out he used the 909 drum machine. That was kind of like a house drum machine at that time. I don't know if you know, am I too nerdy now? But
You tell, there's lots of people who listen to that and understand
okay.
it.
And that snare has a really hard pop, but it also has a very distinctive sound. So if you use just that snare, you will sound like all the other records who use that snare. But Teddy used that snare underneath his breakbeat snares. So if he would sample whatever funky drama or, he loved the God Make Funky, that snare, he would all sample, but he would have the 909 underneath, and that's what gave it that whip. And then it was a board called SSL that everybody probably knows if they're working in the music industry, but the SSL compressor. When you take that combination of an 899 and the breakbeat snare, and you put that in through a compressor, and you get that. And he always flammed the beat. He'll have a clap in front of it a little bit, so it would flam a little bit. Don't get me started. I studied him so
No, you
much.
know, because as a
He's such
fan.
an inspiration.
Yeah, as a fan, that you could, I could always tell his drums or his
Oh,
keys
yes.
and everything there.
Absolutely, yes.
But to think that he did this, so you think about your upbringing in Denmark in a rural family where he was in a projects, had no money, had a small Casio keyboard and but had all that talent, and then learning how to do this in a studio, that just shows you that actually when there's talent, it doesn't matter where you're from, it's just
Oh,
in you.
so true. But we used that. Eric B. and McKim had that line. It's not where you're from, it's where you're at.
Eight when you're from
That
where you
became
when
our
again.
kind of mecca for us Danes, because we were really outsiders. We showed up, and as I said, in today's culture, it's normal. But that back then, and then we came with an accent and wearing shorts, flower shorts. We looked, I can't tell you how many times we went into the studio and people were like, I remember we had a session with Patti LaBelle. This is kind of early on. And we were starting to buzz a little bit because Latifah had us produce a record, four songs on her second album, especially with a song called Fly Girl that got nominated for a Grammy and stuff like that. And we were like, oh my God, we barely knew what we were doing. And owe so much to Latifah. So we started getting some, remix jobs, and we made a lot of remix, soul power remixes of Chill Rob G's and Jungle Bros. So we're busting a little bit, and I guess Patti LaBelle wanted to get that sound. I think our first big remix was Toni Braxton. I Belong to You, I think it's called. We did like a kind of roller skate mix, we call it, but we actually sampled the beat from Gap Band, Outstanding. That's the beat underneath. We had the flash and everything. But I probably shouldn't have said that now. I probably got sued now. But anyways, so I remember we showed up, and I'm sitting in the room, and Patti LaBelle walks in with her entourage, hairdressers, and she's like, can you get me this and this and that? I need this, and also I need some this and that kind of tea. If you don't have that tea, you need to go get that tea. Like, we need it before Soul Shark shows up.
Oh,
So I'm
did
like, okay. And I just got up and I said, okay, I'll go get it. And then my assistant said to her, that's Soul Shark. And we went through that so many times in the beginning of our career. And it really wasn't until Tupac, when Tupac took us under his wings and we started having big records with him. If you work with Tupac, it didn't matter if you're from Mars or where you're from, we got the stamp. So after Tupac, it was kind of like, okay. I don't think people really still knew we were white, but you are the guy that Tupac way, right? Yeah, okay, good. We just want to make sure.
Oh goodness.
So
Oh, I didn't realize he sent you to go get the stuff because she just assumed you were the engineer, so
yeah, totally. She was like, there's no way that that's like no way that that's Soul Shark. Just no way.
Oh goodness. I mean, how did you guys then? I mean, you said You got into your DJ stuff. Now, with your parents being academics, were you still going to school, secondary school and university while doing the DJ stuff, or did you? Oh, what?
Oh,
Oh.
and it was a ongoing battle because, I just was burning so much for this music, and my dad really wanted me to have some kind of
Back up.
academic, education backup plan. There you go. I hear myself actually saying a little bit like my said, I say that to my son now. And he's like, Dad, please. We made a deal, and I said, okay, I'll do business school. So I did 3 years of business school, barely making it because I was practicing and I was in, championships, and I flew to New Music Seminar, was another very, very famous DJ kind of competition where also rappers were. And that's actually where Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince first gets discovered. And unfortunately, I was up, Jazzy Jeff was there. And yeah. I mean, I was good, but I'm not Jazzy Jeff. No, he's another
Oh, so
legend.
you were in the same competition with
Yeah, we
Jazzy.
and that's battle that you get one time and that's it. You got to show what you got. It's a knockout round.
And I heard from
But 1 minute.
Jazzy in an interview that he really was ready to
He
battle.
Jazzy was unbelievable because we didn't know anything about transform scratch. We could do a lot of stuff, but when he did, I'm like, wait, am I going up next? Because if I'm going up after that, I have no secrets. I have no secret weapons to beat that. That's just insane. We could do all the fast scratching, but that transform scratch, and I actually think it's Cash Money maybe did the first time. But Jazzy Jeff, he went to that competition and bam, we were like, okay, we're going back to Denmark. Then we're done. Not a chance. Yeah, he was insane good to scratching. He was insane good, Jazzy Jeff.
Well,
So
how soon?
I did that and I finished my business school, and as I said, my first try going into the music industry was New York. And we had done a record in Denmark called Break the Limits. And because we were so good friends with Red Alert and became so good friends with MC Lyte and Audio 2 and their dad, Nat Robinson, he actually put that song, Break the Limits, on his label, which was, they had like a whole album with all their big hits. And he put our song, and it was crazy, because, we're from Denmark, So I had a good moment, but I have to say New York was rough for me because straight from Denmark to New York, it was just, and it was aggressive, because it was a really hello from the ghettos. Like, no one wants to listen to us. No one's paying attention. The police doesn't even come into the ghettos when there's issues in the ghettos. Where are they gonna get, who are they gonna talk to? And rap in some way started becoming very, or more political in some way. Public Enemy started on the stage and stuff like that too. So it was just intense. And then on top of that, you had the baddest motherfuckers in the world. So you got Premier, Molly Mall, Teddy Riley's coming up. It's just like, wait, how are we gonna get through? And that Patti LaBelle session I was talking about, where she sent me out in the kitchen, was in L.A. And once I came to LA, like palm trees, sunshine, no one shooting, at least not right here. And more importantly, they had one bad motherfucker. They had Dr. Dre out here. But besides that, I kind of felt we could compete with many of the other ones. That's why we settled in LA.
I mean, I could have, I, I've heard a lot of those who I've interviewed from New York and from the East Coast, and they talk about how rough it is in the East Coast, from Philadelphia to New York. There is no hiding. So those who have grown up there talk about how rough it is, whether it's in the Bronx or things like that. They're just coming out of the crack epidemic. They're dealing with
Beyond.
so much things out there. So the thought that I can't imagine what your English was like. If you're British, I could
Oh,
understand
it's
being. I mean, I don't know the
super,
accent.
super. heavy accent back then, and like a little white boy with blonde. I mean, you should see some pictures of me. You'll be like, how did you get shot? And you know, but I also loved it though, because I must say, as much as I felt it was scary, I also loved it. I had studied all these, you know, record sleeves and looking at all the pictures.
The credits
I'm
and
not
everything.
in it. Not only that, my name is on some of these. It was so exciting for me, you know, and I didn't care about money or any. I just wanted to be part of the hip hop culture. So as much as this was rough, it was also amazing. I mean, had some amazing moments. I was spinning in a club called Club Mars. It was very famous hip hop club in the Meat Pat District when it was as rough, not the fancy one you see now in New York. You don't really see any of that stuff that we saw back then. It was crazy. 42nd Street was crazy back then. Crazy. It was Hell's Kitchen was Hell's Kitchen. That's the best way to describe it. But anyways, you know, I remember a night Q-Tip came straight from the vinyl pressing and came up to me, go, my God, first Tribe Called Quest record. And you're gonna play it? And I go, of course I'm gonna play it. So I played
Also,
this and
you
they
know
go,
Q-Tip.
cool. Yeah, because he was part of Red Alert and everything too. So Q-Tip came, gave me the pressing at Mars, and I played Definition of a Fool for the first time. So I had amazing experiences too, meeting all these people. I met JC before he was JC. He was still JC, but driving around in a Mercedes with stickers in his car promoting himself. So it was incredible, you know, but it was rough. It was rough. And then times maybe two or three, because we were little white boys. We really careful. I mean, we really had to be careful, not overstepping our boundaries. And we had to be fucking good, like really good to compete, you know. So we had to practice so much, study so much, learn. Also, we got into R&B music. We had to study church gospel music because a lot of the vocals are very inspired by that. We need to learn all the runs and all the stuff. So, you know, we studied everything and were very humble. Very humble, but also competitive. You have to be hip hop culture. That's kind of part of it. Someone said to me, I'll be like, well, let's get on the fucking turntables then. Let's see what you got. You know, you that was you had to have a little bit of that hip hop attitude as well, or else you just get rolled over. But I did find coming to LA a lot easier.
So before you get to LA, were you so, because what is strange to hear is that if Latifah and Jungle Brothers are going on tour around Europe, you would always assume that they needed their own DJ, because if a DJ messes up, it's on them. So why
Well,
would they
hey,
trust?
I was third in the world.
Okay,
They had their own DJ.
but didn't they have their own DJ back? Could they not travel
No, but
out?
I became her DJ. So Latifah, we did shows in America too. You
But
know,
did,
that
oh,
wasn't
sorry.
just in Europe. Yeah.
Oh,
So
did she
Latifah,
have a DJ before they came to Europe?
she just had, Mark the 45 Kin. But, he wasn't, DJ in that sense, By the way, he passed away recently, so RIP to him. You know, he did the 900 number stuff like that. I assume you know who that is. He's a legend too. And he wasn't really, he was more producer DJ. He couldn't do all the scratching and stuff like that. And you actually had to be really fucking good because you were right. When I took the way we performed with Latifah and Trilogy, it's me extending the beats. And she goes, I want to do a breakdown like when you do funky drama. And she's rapping. If I mess up,
That's what I'm thinking.
she'll mess up. So the reason why they picked so good DJs, it was because technical, we were a band. And we had to be uber good. So I think in the way what Red Alert saw, if this guy can stay on his head and run around and do cutback, whatever, he can definitely hold the beat, you know. And there were some nights where I had to DJ for Jungle Brothers too, with Sammy B sometimes, if he was sick or something like that. So I had a couple of nights where I was DJing for Jungle Brothers. And yes, I looked like I was the coolest guy in the world. I was pissing in my pants. I mean, fuck, I need to make, are you kidding me? I better get that over there again. And that needle better not skip. because they are rapping right now. Oh, and here's a drop. And I got to get in again. Okay. You know, so it was really intense on us DJs. You know, now you see the DJ more who maybe do some live scratching, but it's all recorded on Pro Tools and so on. But that tape, CDs came out. But back then, we were in vinyl records, and sometimes we wouldn't even have an instrumental version. So we would have to make our own instrumental. Some of it, you know, Wrath of My Madness. We didn't have an instrumental of it. That was Latifah. So I had to cut the beat. That was, I had to extend the intro so she could rap. What else would you be rapping on herself?
Maybe that's why you guys make really good producers, like, you know, because that sense of being able to, the creativity and the innovation that you
and then also when you're in the club, like for example, when I was spinning at Mars and I had the hip hop room and I got 600-700 hardcore B-boys from New York in front of me. Let me tell you, we probably know what we're doing.
Yeah.
And that helped me too, reading the floor. And I think that's another thing DJs, a thing of good at. We've been at clubs where a record doesn't work. No, you know why that doesn't work? Because the bass, the 808 sounds like it's like, I mean, there's no bottom in it, man. How am I going to play this record? It might be a dope record, but whoever mixed this record, I can't go from pump that bass to this because it sounds so thin. And, you know, I'm not going to mention who that was. but they had records that sounded very thin. So you also learn, oh, that intro really works. People want to hear that one more time. Okay, maybe just drop it so it's twice instead of only one time. So I'm reproducing in some way the original record.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's really where producing came in, was also working and knowing these rooms in front of them and learn how what you could do to a record to make it work. So when we did ours, started doing our stuff, you know, hopefully people will notice we got beats. We had hip hop beats, you know, on our song with Monica before we all got our life, you know, when that beat drops in, you know, that was one of our big ones. That was typical us. We would be like, oh, it's a little pretty song. And then.
Yeah. No, before we get into the tracks and stuff, I guess, how did you meet Colin then? Did you meet him in Denmark?
Yes. So, you know, when I came back from New York, EMI.
This is after the shooting.
This is after the shooting. Yeah, I'm back home with mom.
Okay.
I'm like, fuck this shit. I can't do this. Then we had already got so much buzz, and, you know, we were in the press in Denmark because we were Grammy nominated for Queen Latifah, and Denmark was like, what?
Wow.
That's the rapper from New York. Yeah. What are those two from Ulfborg and Holbæk doing with Latifah in New York? So we got offered a record label by this guy called Michael Ritto, who became head of EMI Records in Scandinavia, because now the Danish artists wanted that hip hop sound. And so we started remixing all these rock bands who had been laughing at us. And we started putting, and Soul to Soul had just came out. Okay, we'll put that beat on, because that beat is really originally from Bismarck and Big Boogers, you know, that the jazz just sampled. But hey, it was genius what he did, because that became a whole new trend. And then we spent 2 years, and we did some Danish bands with this band called Cut and Move that got signed in America, whatever. We had tremendous success doing all these Danish acts, but I had been in New York.
You've been into the Mecca, the Golden Grail.
What is that, Nando's?
Yeah,
that chicken place you have?
Yeah, Nando's, yeah.
You can't go to someone called Nundo's. Yeah. You know, no, I want Nando's. So that was what it was. So I remember after 2 years, I just said, we got to go back. And we were originally, it was Soulshock, Cutfather, and Colin. The original team was Cutfather and Soulshock. And then we went to America, and it was so rough. I mean, even LA wasn't rough in the sense we got shot at or anything like that, but it was impossible to get our tracks out into the A&R system. You know, even though we'd done the Tifa and Jonah Bus, you know, all the really heavy executives are still like, cool. You know, we couldn't get a meeting with the assistant to the A&R person.
Wow.
You know, so cut 5 to 6 months goes, I'm going back home. And I just felt, we're better. We're better. I hear the music coming out. I'm telling you, Colin, right now. We're better. You know, we're not better than Jimmy Dame Terry Lewis or LA and Babyface or Teddy
Yeah.
Riley, but we're better than, and I'm not going to
Some
mention
yeah,
the other
you
guy.
got some
Yeah, many
yeah.
other ones. And I just said, if you, because he wanted to go home too, and I said, if you, I promise you, in 6 months we're going to have a top 10 record if you stay with me, and we did.
So just before I asked what the record was, but what about the opportunity you had back at home? Because 100% who apart from Brian Abrahams from Call Me Bad, every all of my guests have been white, a black, and they've talked about bad record deals and how they got shafted and stuff like this. Here you are telling me that EMI says, hey, here's a record deal, so we're gonna bring you partners, and so then all of a sudden it means that you have a different understanding about the industry, about contracts, from a very different from an early stage. So that did you understand the opportunity you have was not given to anyone? I mean, only
First of
top,
all,
yeah.
what an amazing thing for you to catch on what you just said, because that's actually incredible. You, because you are so right. I knew nothing about anything except scratching. And I think, you know, what we had accomplished. Denmark is a very small country. It's only
Yeah.
6 million people. You've got two guys who were nominated for a Grammy for someone, for Queen Latifah. That's on your main nightly news.
Wow.
We interviewed, yeah. So, and plus hip hop music, even everybody said it was going to die and go away. No, it grew and grew and grew. And Europe made their own little funny version, Snap or whatever they were called from
Yeah,
Germany.
yes,
You know, like hip hop, and you know, and Mantronic, Curtis Mantronic, you have to pay some respect for him too, you
Yeah,
know.
I had
A
Branch
lot of that
Wilson,
stuff.
yeah.
Yes. Came to an England, you know, Derek B. Don't
Derek
sleep
B,
with Derek B. Don't sleep with Derek B. You
we
know,
had Nina
that's,
Cherry, you had a number of people in the
and Nina
new,
Cherry, Buffalo's Dance. As a matter of fact, the record I did in Denmark, the rapper was Nina Cherry's little brother, CPU. Yeah. So it was coming in Denmark, soul to soul, whatever. So, and there were no one else than us in Denmark that had put out records. I mean, you put out records in New York. So we were kind of like, whoa. So everybody was trying to get us to make these beats for them because that was the ultimate in Denmark. So it wasn't so unusual for us to get that in Denmark because there was no one else doing it. Where I can understand New York, I could, if you take artists and stuff like that, blah, blah. But the point I'm really impressed that you picked up on was, yes, this was an amazing opportunity for me to learn the business. And I was so green. I remember the first act we signed was this girl, Yasmin, and we actually ended up signing her to Geffen Records in America, and CJ McIntosh actually from your country did a remix of that. Because CJ McIntosh, I remember he was also around DJing, you know, and he was also in those competitions. I don't know if you remember him. But then I remember having a meeting and we're talking, and the artist goes, or the artist manager goes, look, I'm like the head label head, okay? I'm sitting with a cap on. And you know, Public Enemy T-shirt or something, and he's like, "What about publishing?" I said, "Let me just, I'll get right back to you. Just give me 1 second. I just got to take this phone call." And I ran down to Michael Ritter, who was head of the company, who assigned us, who was giving us this record, and goes, "What's publishing?" And he goes, "Just say yes, we take that too." So I knew nothing. So those 2, 3 years running a label were actually amazing. It really gave me a lot coming to America, getting into the business. I wouldn't say I knew everything, but I had a big understanding of royalties, copyrights, publishing shares. And as a producer, you get your mechanical royalties and you get the royalties from producing. You know, all that stuff I knew when I came back to LA. I almost feel in some sense going back home from New York to Denmark was like, let me, first of all, recover from what happened and maybe learn a little more, go a little more in the studios, because we were in the studio every day with a bunch of Danish acts, and we couldn't care less what they were talking to sing about, as long as we had a beat. I remember one point we had a sample of a Big Payback, you know, James Brown. And we just, that's going on the song, and the guy who was the producer or the band member goes, well, we're not in that key. That's a major. We don't. No, that's a minor. We're in major. And I go, change the song. We need to get that guitar on. We were just brutal. We wanted hip hop. You know, we just. It wasn't even about the songs, but that snuck up on us too. And that's coming later. We'll get to that part. Yeah. But then, as I said, then I just didn't. When you taste the Nandos,
Well, so I mean, that's really good that you actually had that opportunity to learn all that stuff, because, you know, you can't, you can have the fame, but without the fortune, it's almost pointless. You know, it's you know, Jodeci, when I interviewed them, they were like, we were selling all these records, but we realized we weren't making any money, and we didn't understand the business side. And their parents, who were
their label was also called Bad Boy.
Yeah, that's the thing. Because you make,
and they, and Bad Boy had a label deal with Uptown, so I they probably got, I can't even imagine how little they probably got. Actually, I feel so bad.
Yeah.
By the way, what an amazing move, Devante Swing. Let's not sleep on him.
No, no. I think people, I think people forget how much he changed the industry with R&B, with his keyboard, his sort of his writing. I mean, they wrote Forever My Lady when they were 14 or so, you know, he was just writing songs with for just for the sake of it. But yeah, as a producer, he's.
Well, I can tell you as a producer, if you listen to our song with Toni Braxton, I Love You Some Him,
Love Me Some
you should
Him,
go back after this. Boom, shot. I'm doing a reverse snare to the snare. Where did I get that from? Jodeci. Devante always had a reverse snare before the snare hit. So it'd be dum, sh, dum, sh. And that sh was the snare being reversed, going, and on I Love Me Some Him, I was like, we're going Jodeci on the snare on that one.
Wow.
So he is another huge inspiration. And Jodeci, I mean, when they came in records, it was, tell me. No, that's not even them. That was actually another group.
Drew Hill. Yeah,
that was Drew Hill, yeah. But Jodeci had so many records that was insane.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That was just, and they were so Bad Boy-ish.
Yeah.
You know, took, you know, that rap look and attitude to R&B. And I think that was Puffy's brilliance. You know, he is kind of the one who really took rap and R&B. You could barely see what was rap and what was, you know, R&B at one point. It was just all mixed together.
Yeah. Yeah, he did have a massive influence on, and I think that was what Uptown, they first came out with the new Jack Swing, with the hip hop, with not just Guy, but Heavy D and the Boys and Father MC doing the new Jack Swing. Then they did the hip hop soul.
Remember Teddy producing Heavy D? How crazy was that?
Yeah, that first album.
How We Found Love. I got Heavy.
Yeah, as I said, it, and I think the whole Uptown, you know, the whole introduction into, you know, as I said, hip hop soul. So Teddy did the new Jack Swing, and then they took the hip hop soul. It was like, okay, let's do hip hop with the soul on it, and the combination. So they took it to another level.
It really did.
Yes, yeah. But when it's focused on you,
so every time you bring up something, you can hear I'm a fan too.
Yeah.
I'm not just the producer. No, I've been a fan of hip hop and R&B ever since I was 13, you know, 12.
But and I think it's good that people see that, because it's important that they understand, because as I said, those people who might think, oh, he's just coming in and taking our stuff, to understand that actually you in Denmark are listening and DJing. I don't think many people would then realize that you actually DJ for Latifah. So you've gotten seal of approval from hip hop legends. People won't realize that. They will just think. So it's important to hear all of this. But also the fact that you go to LA. Why didn't you guys go back to New York? Did you go to New York first? Then
well,
LA?
We went straight to LA. I was like, we're not going to New York. I can't. And
no,
then
it was
at that point, Puffy. That's 19. We arrived in LA in 1993.
Okay, so 93 is when I moved to I was in Alabama, so I moved to the States in 93 as well. So
Oh,
that was
wow.
yeah, so that was 93 when I moved to LA, moved to the US, to Alabama. So I think we had SWV just with their coming out with their type of music. We had
Oh, yes, did we? Boy, did we.
I think we were getting yeah, so I mean New York hip hop was
We definitely had Jodeci. Jodeci too was, I mean, Puffy definitely was. I think Biggie might have started around 93,
So in
maybe.
93 he came out with Flavor in the Air and the Biggie stuff in 94. That 93 he
Yeah,
Joe
there you
he
go.
yeah so that 93 we were just we you know we
But that's
had
what I meant. Now in New York, you had them as well. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there it just seemed like every competition was in New York. And that what that meant was it was hard to get meetings with the record companies because we would be way down the list. You know, I mean, if you got like, you know, all the producers who are currently making records in New York, and that was a closed scene, they're gonna be ahead of us. So it was just hard for us to get in. And we also just, I think we needed a little bit of the peace, honestly. I mean, New York is really hectic, man. You go down the street and it's like, and you go into the studios, everybody is just going crazy in the studios. You know, I remember when we always flew to New York and made records, you know, like, you know, I remember the session we did with Silk, did a song called Hooked on You. And you know, every room next to us, it was, I mean, Busta Rhymes was coming in
Was
and
that
going,
the Hit
this is
Factory or where was this?
yeah, it was.
Okay. Yeah, and I can imagine because everyone I talked to who worked out of the Hit Factory, it's either, you know, even Teddy talks about, you know, Q-Tip having a room and he needed
Oh
a room
yeah.
for Michael Jackson, then
Totally.
Puffy pretty much took over half the
Totally.
place. So I can imagine how congested it would be just to try and get
To
your
get into the
just
studio.
to get into a studio
Yeah.
to
That's
work. Okay. And I think LA
yeah.
would have been, yeah, it didn't seem as if much was happening in LA recording wise. I mean,
Really had Dre, NWA, and of course, you know, Warren G and whatever, but there was just it was more a South Central, you know, West Coast hip hop scene that was had his had had that. When it came to like the whole R&B hip hop scene, we felt we were gonna take over. Honestly, we felt very confident in it. Like, you know, just with the people that were there, and it and we did very fast, you know, but we needed to learn one more thing before we could go there. That's what we're talking about, songs. But I don't know if you want me to get into that or you want us to
Go
quick.
ahead.
Yeah. But when we came here, you know, we started like writing songs. But I was obsessed with the beats. It was all about the beats, man. You know, and Colin was doing his keys, and then, oh, there's someone singing. Oh, yeah, cool. We're just making beats here. You could just sing whatever you want to do, kind of thing. And I remember we knew if we want to get into the ultimate level, we needed a meeting with Clive Davis.
The Godfather.
So we worked on it and we worked on it and we worked on it. And we finally got a meeting with Clive Davis. And my first meeting with Clive Davis was at the Peninsula Hotel here in LA, because he would come out here all the time. And again, when he was in LA, there was less people to see. I mean, Puffy would still be here and whatever. And when Clive was in town, everybody would just kind of like get together around Clive. But I remember coming in and meeting him for the first time, and we played three songs. And I'm like, man, he's listening to every song all the way through. We're in. And when he was done, he looked at me and goes, that is possible. The three worst songs anyone has ever played me.
Wow.
And I looked over at Colin and he goes, thank you. You can leave now. And we got up, and his assistant, who was Keith Nafferty at that time, said to us, before we walked out the door, he goes, Clive wants to see you next month. I go, what? So we walked down the stairs and we go into studio again. I'm like, okay, I think I need to think a little more about what's on top of the tracks.
Okay.
Because you know, in rap, it was kind of like Jesus, like, you just follow the rapper. You know, you didn't really, you
Okay,
know, yeah,
hip-hop
they would just spit,
producers.
and then the hook would just be like, nothing would just say, you do a little sample, and So we did three more songs, and we had another meeting. This was the S Peninsula Hotel also. And we come in again, and it was kind of weird because David Foster and Ella and Babyface kind of, they walked out and stuff, and I'm like, oh my fucking God. And so we played three songs, we played all the way through, but now I'm like worried, but I'm like, okay. And he goes, you know what's really fascinating? So I go, no. How is it possible to come with three songs that are worse than the front? And I'm like, this
Wow.
motherfucker. And I walked out, and Keith Nabb goes, Clive won't see you again next month. I'm like, what the fuck is going on here, man? What is going on here? So we went down. And I think this is where, make or break it kind of thing. He was pushing us. And before he left, he said, let me play you what I'm looking for. And we'll play a Teddy Riley song, Alien Baby song, especially Jimmy Jam's Hurt Loose and Alien Babyface. They're songs. Amazing. And he did say, if you really want someone to listen to your beats, make a good song. Then everybody's going to hear your beats. So he did plant some seeds in us. And at that time, I started dating Maxie, from Brownstone. And we had just been in the studio with them, and I just saw her, and we just fell in love and became like, we were just soulmates from the moment we saw each other. We went, I had a little house, and Maxie was kind of living with me, and we had this songwriter coming up called Andrea Martin. And Maxie was from Guyana, and Andrea was also from Guyana. So, or her, some of her family members were, I think. And so Max was cooking Guyanese food, and totally different vibe than we normally would do in a session. And Andrew is like doing, and Colin is sitting up there. He always had these, he would listen to all these like Toto and all these bands. I was like, what are you listening to? But actually, he starts playing these chords, and he does some changes that are unusual for an R&B writer. And they write this song. We go to Clive. And now he's at the Bellevue Hotel, always a Bungalow 8. I'm sure you heard that from other people. That was the whole Mecca. And when we came there, Prince walked out, casually. Oh, hello, Prince. Again, maybe we're just not meant to be here. Like, this is too high level. Like, we go in and we press play, and he stops after the first song. We had three songs again, and he goes, 1 second. And he goes, Roy Lott, I need you to go in the room with Soulshock and Collins' manager. We're buying this record right now on the spot. And I need, they're not leaving until they sign the contract. And I'm like, what? And that was before he walked out of my life. And he said, I have a new artist called Monica, and I want her to do this song. And he goes, and if you just listen to me, you're going to have your first number one. And we did. But the story is not quite over yet, because we walk out of that bungalow, and guess who's calling? L.A. Reid. He goes, love this record. We want Toni Braxton to record it. I'm like, fuck yeah. Who cares? Monica. Who knows? No one knows who Monica is. So I'm like, yeah, we in. So I go to the studio the next day, and I was at the studio called Skip Sailor. It's like a hip hop studio in L.A. And Skip Sailor, the owner of the studio, comes running into my room and goes, fucking Clive Davis is on the phone for you. And I go, how does he know I'm here? And Skip goes, how does he know me? I'm my recording studio. But you should run. And so I run out, and I pick up the phone, and he goes, this is Clive Davis. I go, yeah. He goes, you will record before I walk out my life with him. And you know why? And I go, no, because I'm fucking Clive Davis, and you won't work in this industry if you don't. We did Monica.
L.A. Reid was signed to Clive. You couldn't.
No, they actually hadn't. They were messing around with each other, but they hadn't done that official merge. But
LaFace?
that's, yeah, LaFace was still in Atlanta. This is very early on. We did This is when Toni Braxton could still live. They might have had a label deal, but they weren't like Aris in the face.
No, they weren't the Aris. No, yeah. But they were this. So Clive gave them their deal.
Distribution, maybe, or something like that. It was kind of it was definitely still competition between LA and Clive's song. Happens again later.
LA would tell you that. Because especially when the Toni Braxton said she wanted money, they did say, look, Clive gives us the money and we put out the artist. So did LA know that Clive wanted the record? Because I can't imagine he would have asked you for it if he knew that Clive wanted it.
Well, he didn't know it because it was right after we had just stepped out.
Yeah, if he know, I
but
don't think
let
he
me tell you one thing.
Yeah.
LA called me afterwards, was furious at me for not giving me the record to Toni Braxton.
Even when you told him that Clive asked for it first?
Well, I said Clive wants it. He goes, I want it for Toni. I don't care. Oh. So they still had, LaFace was still 50% of their company. They were not necessarily butching. And, LA didn't talk to me for like a year and a half. And then next time it happens, it's Heartbreak Hotel that he wants for TLC and Clive wants for Whitney. And Clive wins again. So me and LA, we're very good friends today. Don't worry.
No. But what was different about how you came up with that track then?
So that's what Colin. Dun, 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 that's kind of a little more classic R&B, but then he starts doing these changes, leading chords going up to the hook, which was very more something you would hear in the total world and that kind of world. And then I came in with the beat, the second verse is so hip hop. It's from this old breakbeat, static on against. It's so dirty. And I think I'm scratching "It's Yours" with T. La Rock. It's somewhere in the background too. It's so hip hop on top of these chords. And then let's not forget Andrea Martin.
Oh, she wrote the lyrics.
She wrote the song, the lyrics. Yeah. And I think the whole vibe also with Maxi cooking food. And I learned a little bit in that session. Okay, if we just sit with our headphones on and just one of our beats, we won't make those records. We got to put our focus on the writer and the song. And we really learned that from Clive Davis. That was really where it clicked for us that, pay as much attention still to your track. But when you're in with a songwriter, they deserve all attention and deserve all our focus. And that's the only way to write a good record. And, Babyface is the master of that. He'll just sit right on a keyboard before he barely put a drum on. So that was our learning experience was that, hey, it's still the song. Yes, that's a dope beat. Hallelujah. But the songs that we really get attached to in our life is really those songs that are special. And that's the song. That's the lyrics.
The lyrics.
Yeah. So we had, and being Danish, it wasn't that easy just to.
With the English language, yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't our main language,
Yeah.
And there was a lot of stuff we had to learn, we really had to learn that. That's when I think after that record we start just going, okay, we got it now. We understand the attention we have to pay to the songs on top of our beats.
Can you talk about, we lost Sandra Martin recently, but I don't think. But we lost Sandra Martin recently, but I don't think she got the credit that she deserves as a songwriter, because she wasn't in front of the cameras like say Missy or Diane Warren, and you're talking about knowing her as a as almost like a family member, the way you described that session. What was she like? So for people who don't know her, but maybe know a few of her songs, but what was she like?
Absolutely 100% one of the most talented songwriters we've ever worked with. And singers. In case you don't know, she's the one singing on that house record, Show Me.
Yeah.
That, Robin S. There is no Robin S. That's Andrew singing that song. Yes. I didn't know it either until recently.
Yeah.
But definitely find out when you hear it. Now you know it's Andrew. And Andrew didn't even, she was so sweet. She was so humble. And she just let that happen. Like, they take her demo vocals, put out a record and call Robin S and have someone strange
Milli
girl
Vanilli,
appear.
whole Milli the whole Milli Vanilli stuff.
Yes, it is before Milli Vanilli, I think. No, maybe after. Yeah,
yeah.
probably. But anyways, yeah, that's Andrew singing. And you know, all many of our big songs, I Love Me Some Him, Toni Braxton, that's Andrew as well.
Oh. So then how did the working relationship happen? And did you would you have would she then write something, or would Carlin and you play something and she would write on top of it, or how did it then work?
She would just come in, and it was always chaos, and it was just beautiful. But we had now learned to really pay attention to them when they walk in, and treat every person that walks into the studio as the most important person when you walk in. So you don't just sit in the corner and do a beat, whatever. So we just started having fun. And, you know, one thing with me and Colin, we really have this sarcastic European humor that they don't necessarily get in America. You know, many times, you know, some engineer would have the hi-hat really loud, and Colin would be like, should turn up the hi-hat a little bit. And then he would turn it up. And we were like, no, okay. You know, so, but Andrea had our humor too. So we just had so much fun. And most of the times it would be Colin sitting with some chords, a little bit like bass, and her humming. Or I would have put some beats on, so it was more like a track already. And we would just play 3, 4, 5 tracks. And she would just go, that's it. And she would just go in, and she would just write the song on the spot.
Wow.
Like in the room. Like, while she's figuring out the melody, she's writing the lyrics. I love me some him. Who just sit there going, what is going on? Like, you know, she was so incredible. One of the most amazing talent songwriters. You know, Clive Davis did sign her, and he did try to put her out as a solo artist. You know, I don't know if there is an Andrea Martin.
There
CD.
Wasn't out yet. It wasn't out yet. Yeah, but it didn't.
And
yeah.
maybe she was a songwriter. That's okay too. You know, maybe she was not an artist. You know, it's not necessary just because you write good songs that you're an artist. You know, we see examples of that all the time. Sometimes it is, but a lot of times it's not. You know, Sean Garrett, amazing songwriter, his solo career didn't necessary. But then you see sometimes a Neo. Okay, that worked. What makes the difference?
You just know, no.
Many things.
Yeah.
Comes into, yeah.
So, but then did you and Colin then start to write the lyrics as well? Then how did you then start to get more comfortable writing the lyrics and thinking, feeling more comfortable with what you were writing and producing?
We started like paying attention to having concepts. And it sounds a little boring, but we realized if there wasn't a concept, then it would be hard to get people to remember that record, because even though it would be a bunch of beautiful words, if there wasn't a story or a concept where that line ties it all together, then it's hard to get that impact. So we would always give all the top writers all the freedom in the world. We would never go in and nitpick in the process, because we really believe in it's like a painting. When you paint, if you go in and say, I don't like it, and the guy goes, well, that red you don't like is actually going to be green. I'm about to put blue. You know? Like, so you've got to kind of let them go through the process. And Harold Lilly, who's one of my really good friends, and one of my just mentors in this business too, he wrote all the stuff on the GPs and stuff like that. And he always says, trust the process. Which is, just let them do that part. Even though maybe you can hear something, let them, you don't know. And then when you're done, you go, you know what? I think, you know, we need to come up with a line that's kind of like that punchline that, you know, end of the hook, you know, you say that line and kind of go, whoa, it's about a girl. It's not even about a guy, or, you know, something like that, you know? So that's the way we have done it more. I would say Colin, like, for example, Heartbreak Hotel got really involved in lyrics. But I, you know, really our main thing was to give them space. And then once we were going there, we were going, now melodies we got very involved in. And that's, I think, being Scandinavian. You know, why are there so many good Scandinavian pop producers? You know, you have Max Martins and
Mark
all these
Martin.
stuff,
Yeah, yeah,
Dennis
yeah.
Hopps. And I think one of the reasons is when we grow up, our first time we get attached to a song, we don't know what they're saying. We're 6, 7 years old, but we like the melody.
Yeah, yeah.
So you most can, you know, like, you know,
You've
I
got
don't know. We,
Ace of Base, ABBA. You've got
Stargate, you
Stargate.
know.
Yeah. Oh, I love
So, you know,
Stargate.
good
Yeah.
friends of ours. Yeah, they're so sweet. Yeah. And they're so thankful for us. They feel we paved the way. They're always, when they meet us, like, you're the reason why we even dare coming over to America. You
Wow.
know, so we have a great relationship. Yeah. But, you know, it's because, so melodies is another thing that we go really hard on melodies, really hard on melodies. So I think it's a combination of things, but always respect in a studio and not, it's not, never ego. And no one is necessarily right. We just open doors, and trust me, when something is the best, we all know. It's
Yeah.
pretty simple. But always open different doors to see what's in each room. You want to try to rap there? Sounds like a horrible idea, but let's try it. You know what I mean? Well, why not? We'll spend half an hour, and then we'll confirm, okay, there's not supposed to be a rap there. You know what I mean? So I think that's one of the things we've also learned, that, you know, really kind of the, being in the studio, writing a song is also, you know, you're a therapist. I sometimes have a therapist in the studio, you know?
Yeah.
It, you know, it's part of, it's a big, and a lot of the new producers coming up skip this part. You know, they're just on, because now it's all on online and
Yeah.
computers. And when they go into the room, they just sit there like they do at home. And it's like, if you don't pay attention to that singer right there, you're not going to get a good song.
And it's good that you say this, because when I interviewed Bob Robinson from Tim and Bob, he said something that Jimmy and Jam and Terry Lewis did, and this is when they would say they were working with Tamir. They said, he said, they said, look, what's going on? What do you want to, let's be part of this. You know, say, give us some ideas of what you've been up to, and then we can write it, build something from this. So that it's, you feel some ownership in this, so we know what's going on with you. So, you know, Jimmy used to say the same when they did the Control album, that they followed Janet around, and she talked about her dad trying to take control. She talked about when it took it, some nasty boys were talking to her, and she was like, these nasty boys talk to me, and I didn't, why didn't you help me? And they created a song based on, so that's what Jimmy said. He said all these things, the whole album was based on just having a conversation with Janet and having her talk, and then they just created a song. So when you were saying about paying attention and letting the artist come in, that was what the greats are doing, you know, Tim and Bob and Jimmy and Terry, making sure that they actually, it becomes, they're involved, and it creates a more long-lasting song that isn't sort of force-fed on us.
That's it. But, you know, we do that too. At first, every session we have, the first sometimes 2 hours, it's just talking about what's going on. It's just, you know, getting to know each other. You know, how are you going to go in? And, you know, we see some top lines will come in and they have like 4 sessions in a day. And we will just say, if you just had one, you would write a great song. But that's also the way it works right now. But Jimmy Jam, it's funny you bring up Jim and Jim Jam, because Jim Jam also told me another thing. I remember when we had some of our first hits, and I was sitting next to him at some Clive Davis party, whatever. And I would be like obsessed with like what chart position my song was, whatever. And Jimmy looking at me, listen, all that energy you were spending right there, put that in the studio. Do the best you can in the studio. And once you're done and you know you've done all you can, you let it go. And whatever happens after that, it's out of your control. We're producers. You're not a marketing guy. You know, and I really like that, because it takes attention away in a session, sitting there finding out what songs are blah 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 and all. Focus on what you're doing, and our job is in the studio, and we love it.
The one thing you keep talking about is what's your relationship with Carlin? Because I listened to Jimmy talk about his relationship with Terry. There was no contract. They're more than brothers and more than friends. It's a partnership, and Elliot and Babyface is, yes. So how is it with Carlin? Because you talk with him so
just
glowingly.
But he's just incredible. You know, he's just incredible. I will say that, you know, we had a long, 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 a lot of big records, 702s and Whitney Houston's and all this stuff. And And I remember around 2000, Colin was done. He was worn out
Wow.
from having to deliver hits. And it's what comes with the territory is we start getting paid a lot of money. And we will get a lot of money up front before the song is written. I loved it. Let me buy a Porsche. Great. But what you don't realize in that young phase of your life is you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself. Now you're getting a lot of money for a song that's not even written yet. And we, when they paid us that kind of money, like when R. Kelly was on an album or L.A. Bay or us or Timbaland, or whatever, that was singles. That's where all the money went. So we couldn't write a good song. A good song wasn't good enough. No. They were expecting a number one record.
Wow.
And that catches up with you,
Yeah.
especially Colin, who had the long hours in the studio sitting with every songwriter. So I remember in 2000, he literally, we had a session with Kelly Rowland. He goes, "I don't feel like doing it." And I go, "I don't either, necessary, but they paid us already. We have to do it." He goes, "I don't want to do it." And I'm like, wow. So he took 5 years off. And I was all of a sudden by myself. I was sitting in the studio. I remember I came to my studio. We were down on Sunset Boulevard. And I was sitting at 10 in the morning and I said to Max, "Yeah, I'll see you. We would be home for dinner." "Yeah." I didn't want to tell her yet, you know. And I'm just sitting in the studio and I never turned on the light. And like 6 at night, I'm just still sitting in the same seat. What am I going to do? How am I going to do this? And in those 5 years, I managed to get by. I actually wrote the biggest record I've had in my career, which is Pitbull and Chris Brown, International Love. And I wrote that with or produced that with a guy. I always like to work with people. I don't like to work by myself. I did that with a guy called Peter Biga. But I missed Colin so much. And when Maxie, when I lost her in 2015, he came back. And thank God.
Wow.
And we started working again. And we're just brothers. When you've been through, when you accomplish something like that together, I don't think you're ever going to lose that bond.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I see a lot of people breaking up.
Yeah.
I really think that's something to do with your ego too. And I think with me and Colin, listen, he knows I can be this and whatever. I'm the driving force of our team and whatever. But he knows little Carsten Schack, which is my name inside, and he's still Kenneth Carlin. And it's Kenneth and Carsten. I'm from Aalborg, he's from Rødovre. And that bond will, if you can keep that sincereness in a relationship, probably
Yeah.
goes for marriage too,
Yeah,
actually.
definitely, yeah.
Then you don't lose. If you go on an ego ride and you buy a Porsche and say, it's okay, maybe you do it together. But you also have each other. Sometimes when you're at night, cool, I love this house. I love this 100-inch flat screen I had, but why am I not happy? And him and I, just since we've known each other, so it's the same thing I have with Maxie. Before, when we met each other, she, If You Love Me, hadn't been released yet, and I hadn't had any hits yet. So that's also sincerity we had. We knew our love and I guess you could say, with Colin too, whatever, our respect for each other was sincere. So, when people go through this, I'm so sad when people break up and stuff like that. I understand you need breaks and stuff like that, and you also need separate lives. But I think in me and Colin's case, yeah. I mean, he's so talented. I mean, the guy is crazy on those keyboards.
But as I mentioned, I started off by talking about being a therapist, and part of why I do this was to really highlight that actually those within the industry, as famous and as rich as you guys are, can still struggle with mental health. So for Colin, I can imagine why he would step back, because the pressure and if depression could sink in, there's a lot of self-esteem or anxiety, and you need the break, and most people don't. They try and power through it, and that's important, especially as men. We think we're macho and stuff. So
Always.
I'm glad at least he was able to take that step back. But
And
then
he's the guy who's teaching me that side. I'm more than macho alpha or whatever, but he's the one that constantly, he's more spiritual, and he will, he will just know if he calls me. I'm like, and I'm just like, what happened? Did you run out of coffee? Like, did the bagels not show up? Like, what's going on? So, we just have, he's such a gentle, beautiful soul. And I think he knows me so well that he can always, and just like I can help him, but that spiritual side is definitely him that's, and that's, I think that's why we're still together. That's his, really, I give him that, his credit, because, definitely when we were, had 10 number ones, whatever. I was, woo. I was flying. I did not see many things around me. I was just on top of the world.
Wait,
And,
wait.
thank God to have someone like Colin as a partner. But, because if I had some new American partner, whether also be both Danish, whatever, people could keep things a little grounded, even though grounded at that time would be still out of control for a lot of the people,
Yeah. Hey guys, thanks for watching. Thanks for being a part of Halftime Chat. Please remember to subscribe, share, and comment. But most importantly, why don't you become a member of Halftime Chat? We've got amazing videos, amazing perks, and being able to support the channel. But anyway, thanks for watching. Take care.
I never participated in that kind of
thing. Hey, somewhere in between
us. Well, either loving us.
I wish I did. I'm with you.
With the heat of the moment.
Yeah, I'll be sure. But boys are like growing up.
She's still making an impact. Cool houses down.
I have a
kind of get this one and that one.
So that works for you, but just for me, up.
No, okay, you're okay.
They don't understand what those people work for, men in all spirits.
And act up. And play.
There's no need for you to be running around.
I love all different jobs.
Looking for something new. If it's something new and exciting you're looking for.